From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. American music history is full of great songwriters who wrote batches of hit songs, but whose names most people don't know. This happens especially after the rock era begins and we start expecting singers to write their own songs. But we've had a good deal of fun on Soundcheck in the past by looking at people like Doc Pomus or Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, where you listen and you think, wait, I know that song, and that one, and that one. The same person wrote all of those? Well, today, you'll hear the tragic tale of Burt Burns, who wrote a whole pile of songs that you will probably recognize immediately. That's just one of Burt Burns' many hits written during a brief but hugely influential life. His story is coming up. Also, live music from the Nashville rock band called Moon Taxi. And yes, they do write their own songs. Okay, well, it's practically May, and here in New York, we're expecting spring to begin any month now. And that, of course, means spring cleaning. After the epic winter we've had, I'm actually excited about tackling the mess that is my desk. Who am I kidding? I'm not cleaning my desk. I'm not even sure I could find my desk. But there are lots of other cleaning issues that we music fans might want to take care of this spring. Job one, get the right music for your cleaning project.
Just whistle while you work, and cheerfully
now, for anyone who's seen my desk here at WNYC, you might think I'm not what you'd call a clean person. My staff has insisted on putting a photo of my desk on our website, soundcheck.org, for all to see, and so I will have to admit it's a bit cluttered. But I want to go on record as saying I am a clean person. It's just that there are so many cleaning questions that pertain specifically to us music fans. So we've asked Jolie Kerr to join us on the show today. She's the creator of Ask a Clean Person, the column for websites like Deadspin and Jezebel, and author of the recent New York Times bestseller, My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag, and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. Jolie, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're looking a little shell-shocked.
A little bit. That desk was really something. But I think you actually make a really good point in making a distinction between clean and tidy, because they are two totally different things. They really are. So people who are clean are not necessarily always tidy, and people who are tidy are not necessarily always clean. And actually, in a moment of rare honesty on my part about my own living habits, I'll tell you that I do tend to be a little bit more tidy than actually clean. Although now that I do this job for a living, I like definitely walk the walk a lot more than I maybe used to.
Now, I mean, music fans, especially, you know, music fans who are also collectors of CDs, of memorabilia, of stuff, you know, we have additional problems because we have additional stuff. So let me start with, clutter management, because heaven help you if you go to a serious music fan's apartment or home and say, you know, you should really get rid of those things.
Oh, heavens no. No. So every concert stub is precious, right? It's a precious memory that you don't want to lose out on. So a couple of things. First of all, if the clutter is getting in the way of your daily life, it's time to do something, because those things are not adding to your life. They're detracting. So a lot of clutter management is really taking a step back and having an intellectual or psychic response to this stuff and examining whether or not it's making your life better or making your life worse. And if the answer is it's making your life worse, then it's time to do something about it. The other thing I kind of tell people about their clutter, and I think this is a really good one for music people to keep in mind, is that if you're not willing to take the time, and by time I mean, 2 to 5 minutes, to find a place for something, then how much does it really mean to you? Right? Maybe that's actually not something that means a whole lot to you. If you can't take a minute or two to give it a loving home, then what value does it have, right? Yeah. If you, you know, so I think those are some good sort of mental ways to think about tackling clutter. And then we can talk about some more specific stuff.
All right. Well, I do want to bring up some specific things. We're speaking with Jolie Kerr, the creator of Ask a Clean Person, a column for websites like Deadspin and Jezebel. Her book is My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. So for people who have tons of CDs, you know, I mean, my office is an exceptional example because there's more CDs coming in every day.
That's right.
So it's, you know, it's sort of a deluge. But at home, you know, how do you keep a large collection of things that you really like? I mean, it's like books, too. You know, you're not going to read the same books over and over, but you don't want to throw a book out if you really liked it.
That's right. Well, you know, the first thing is, and this is similar to books, think about if it's not something that you're using and you really are space challenged, think about donating it. A lot of times it makes people feel more comfortable with parting with something if they know that someone else can enjoy it. So good places to donate things like CDs, records are to small libraries, school libraries, public libraries that are smaller ones, senior centers, halfway homes, those kinds of places will really be happy to take those things because the people living there will use them. And then you know it's going to a good home. But that said, there are things that you do want to keep.
Right.
So you have to get realistic about your storage. And when you're picking storage, you always want to pick storage that you can continue to grow into. So don't just, if you have 100 CDs, don't buy a 100 CD rack. You buy a 200 CD mm-hmm. rack so you have space to grow into it.
You know, it's interesting you talk about donating it because we just had a hugely successful instrument drive here at New York Public Radio, our sister station WQXR. They wanted, their goal was to get 1,000 instruments donated for kids in public schools, and they got way over 2,000.
Oh, that's great.
They passed, soared right past 2,500 instruments. People had these instruments in their closets, in their basements, in their mother's attics, or what have you, and given the chance to do something good with an instrument that they kept for sentimental reasons, or I always thought I'd go back to that cello and I never did, here was a place to do it.
Exactly. I think that's a great thing. And I think one of the things that you mentioned is the intention that we have around our objects. Keep in mind that sometimes those objects that you're not using but that you have an intention for can actually weigh you down and hold you back and make you feel bad. If you've got that clarinet that you keep promising yourself you're going to go back to and pick up, every time you look at that, it's going to remind you that you haven't done that.
Right.
So if you can make some kind of peace with the fact that this was an important part of your life at one point, it's now no longer an interest, you can find a new home for it, that's a really good way of freeing up space, but also freeing up a little mental space for yourself and for forgiving yourself for not picking up that clarinet again.
We're speaking with Jolie Kerr, who's talking about how to clean not just anything, but your specifically music-related cleaning questions. So, for example, how do we deal with the clutter of our music collections? But just a kind of a general question about music in particular, this is stuff we've spent money on. Sometimes, if it's equipment, a lot of money.
Absolutely.
And so part of the reluctance to clean is a worry about, if I do this, I might wreck it.
Absolutely,
so
yeah.
Let's take, for example, an iPhone or an iPad or an iPod or some other music playing device.
Right. So generally speaking with any kind of, you know, electronic music playing device, obviously you want to stay away from too much liquid because mm-hmm. you don't want to flood the inner components of the part. But it is important to clean these things because they're in our hands constantly. I mean, I know I take my iPhone to the gym to listen to music. So my grimy gym hand is all over this thing, right? The good news is about cleaning these things is that there's an easy and cheap way to clean them, rubbing alcohol. That's the thing that you want. The other great thing about rubbing alcohol is that you can find these sort of pre-moistened wipes that are you know, impregnated with the rubbing alcohol. They look like handy wipes. They come in a little individual packet. They're low moisture. You know, you don't pull them out and they're not dripping. So
right.
You're not going to worry about flooding any of your components using those. They're also really convenient for throwing in, you know, your laptop case or your guitar case or just shoving one in the back pocket. So those are really great things to use. Those will clean, you know, your iPhone, your iPod, whatever it is you have, any other kind of music players. They also are going to be the thing you want to use to clean your headphones.
Which is going to be my next question.
I figured it might be your next question. So definitely want to clean those headphones. I always joke that I'm kind of like a five-year-old in that I still get chronic ear infections. I'm like the only adult I know who still is plagued with ear infections. So for me particularly, constant cleaning of headphones is really important to me because it helps to stave off any ear infections I can get. I know most adults don't really worry about ear infections, but those headphones do get really grimy. You can see them. You can use those isopropyl alcohol wipes on earbuds. You can also use them on fabric and foam headphones. So really, I mean, any kind of headphone you have, you can use them on that. So it's a great, like, multi-purpose, travel convenient kind of thing.
So these wipes with rubbing alcohol in them.
Exactly.
Even for the foam.
Even for the foam.
Okay.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, just
and
let
you get these at any drugstore.
Drugstore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here in, you know, here in New York, go to the Duane Reade.
Right.
There they are.
Listeners, do you have a music-related cleaning question for Jolie Kerr, creator of Ask a Clean Person? You can leave a comment on our website, soundcheck.org, and take a look at my desk and tell me where you think it ranks on the spectrum of dirty to really dirty. Or you can call us and leave a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's soundcheck.org or 866-939-1612. The book is called My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. What are some of the other things you can't ask Martha?
Definitely. The boyfriend barfed in the handbag. I mean, I feel like actually you could probably ask Martha that. She might not give you a very helpful answer. It might be more like get rid of him and throw the bag away, which isn't very helpful. I mean, I get a lot of questions that have to do with people's sex lives. For sure. Mm-hmm. You know, sex is great, but it's pretty messy. Definitely a lot of party accidents. I mean, constant. Everyone is barfing everywhere. Just constant barf.
Well, now this gets us back to the world of music and especially with the summer festival season coming up. I mean, this is a very common hazard of summer music festivals.
Absolutely.
Is that someone, you or someone near you, get something on your shoes. It could
Absolutely.
Be barf, it could be beer, it could be, or just, you know, mud or whatever.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you from personal experience, I once took a shoe to the face at an outdoor festival. So I am definitely familiar with the shoe problems at festivals. So yeah, spilling on shoes is a very, very common thing to have happen at outdoor festivals, at concerts. You know, beer is probably the number one culprit.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, most people are probably not drinking red wine at outdoor festivals, which is a good thing because that's a bear of a stain.
Although in your book, you point out a kind of surprising way of getting out red wine stains.
White wine?
White wine.
White wine. Yep.
I've never heard that before.
Yep. That's like an old like hostess trick. Yeah. Little bit of white wine. Now, I will tell you, I actually personally don't like that one because I feel like it's a waste of good white wine. So I'd rather use the club soda, which is a great one because I don't mind wasting club soda, but I'd rather be drinking the
what
white wine.
What do you do for beer on your shoes?
So beer, really, it depends much more on the type of shoe than the beer. Beer is actually a pretty easy stain to get out, fortunately, because it's so water-based. So that's a great thing. We really like that. If you've got canvas shoes, basically throw them in the laundry machine. Just don't dry them because the rubber soles won't like that. A little stain remover, like a Shout, a Zout, an OxyClean, any one of those spray stain removers before you launder them, great. You're going to be good to go. On leather.
But first, let me ask. I mean, you're at a music festival. You're probably in the desert of California or the hills of Tennessee or someplace where maybe laundry is not immediately available. So what happens if it's set in for a couple of days?
That's really going to be A-okay. Again, just pre-treat it with a lot. You know, the laundry stain treatment is going to go a long way. So you pre-treat it, let it sit for 30 minutes, an hour before you actually launder it so that the pre-treatment can absorb into the fibers, do its thing, then launder it. I mean, if you think of it, if you're conscientious at this show, I don't really want you to stop having fun and go treat your stains. Mm-hmm. I want you to have fun and worry about it later, which is the same attitude I take about people's sex life. You know, don't worry about the stain when it's happening. Just deal with it later. That's okay. But if you do notice when it happens, if you can just get a little cup of water and, you know, some paper towels and just dab at it, that's really going to go a hugely long way. Same thing if you spill on leather, even just wiping it off with a paper towel is going to really go a long way in getting things clean or cleanish, staving off a you know, more permanent stain. When it comes to leather, really the thing that you need to do, if it's a bad stain, you can use what's called saddle soap, which is basically leather soap. Mm-hmm. You buy it at the pharmacy, the same aisle where you buy shoe polish. It comes in a little tin just like shoe polish. Tiny, tiny little bit of it, though, like less than a pea-sized amount. Rub it in a circular motion with a soft cloth. An old sock or T-shirt is great for that. That should take the stain right out. Then if there's any residual discoloration, just the same color shoe polish as the leather shoe. The last thing is suede. Now, suede is really tricky. If I could ask people not to wear their suede shoes to outdoor festivals, I will ask that. It's probably not going to be that likely. But that's not a great place for suede. You know, mud, dirt, spills. You know, when things get – if it rains, you're really going to have a problem. So not the best time to wear your favorite suede shoes. But if you do, all is not lost. You can get what's called a suede eraser. And you can actually just get one of those white art erasers. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, the big ones.
Yeah, those big white erasers. Those will do the same thing. You just don't want a colored eraser because it's going to leave the color on it. So the white one is really important. And just erase that mark right off the suede. It's amazing how well it works.
Huh. All right.
Yeah.
Well, we've talked a little bit about musical clutter in the home and musical accidents at festivals outside the home. There's lots more that we'll talk about. Jolie will be joining us again later on this week, but she is with us on Soundcheck today talking about music-related cleaning problems. You can leave your comment or question on our website, soundcheck.org, or call us at 866-939-1612. Jolie, we'll see you back here in a couple of days.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, you've heard of Phil Spector, Lieber and Stoller, Burt Bacharach? What about Burt Burns? Don't know the guy? I'll bet you know his music. We'll talk to the author of a new biography about the early rock and roll songwriter and producer. And later, an in-studio performance from the Nashville band Moon Taxi. This is Soundcheck.
Shake it up, baby!
Shake it up, baby!
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It's pretty likely you know this song, Twist and Shout, whether it's the original Isley Brothers version or one of the many cover versions in the decades since, most notably by the Beatles. But you might not know the story behind one of its authors, Burt Burns. Well, that is about to change, because this year, a new stage musical is on the way, also a documentary about this songwriter and producer. And a new biography has just hit the shelves. It's called Here Comes the Night, The Dark Soul of Burt Burns and the Dirty Business of Rhythm and Blues. It's by music journalist Joel Selvin, who sat down with our producer, Joel Meyer, in what might have been Soundcheck's first ever Joel on Joel interview.
Burt Burns, he worked alongside some of the biggest names in Brill Building history. We're talking Lieber and Stoller, Jerry Goffin and Carole King. Why don't we know Burt Burns' name better?
Well, Burns died in 1967 at the age of 38 after a long-expected heart attack. He had rheumatic fever when he was 14 and was told he wouldn't live to be 21. But I think more importantly, Burns made a lot of powerful enemies during his lifetime, especially the Atlantic Records partners Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler, who... I really worked hard to erase him from their company's history. When I started to write this book and I called Wexler and told him I was going to do that, he said, I don't know where he's buried, but if I did, I'd on his grave.
Ugh.
Neil Diamond, whose career Burns started, doesn't speak his name. Wrote a history of his early recordings for liner notes to a reissue a couple years ago, and he mentions everybody associated, but he doesn't even drop Burt's name. Now, Burt Burns signed him to the label, sang on his records, changed the name of his first hit to Cherry Cherry, did all the mixing. I mean, he made Neil Diamond who Neil Diamond became, and this guy can't even mention his name.
So, I mean, Ahmet Erdogan, Jerry Wexler, Neil Diamond, these are all people that, we as music fans know and trust. You know, why shouldn't we believe them about Burt Burns? Why should people get to know the story of Burt Burns?
Those people were trying to take advantage of Burns. You talk to his friends, and it's a different guy. He was a happy-go-lucky, all music, all hit records, all collaborative ethos. Ellie Greenwich sat and cried recalling him to me. Jeff Berry loved him. People loved Burt Burns.
We'll find out a little bit more about his rise through the music industry. But first, you as a music fan should hear some more songs that Burt Burns had a hand in. We opened up the segment today with Twist and Shout, the Isley Brothers version. Let's hear a song by the McCoys, a song that began life as My Girl Sloopy and then turned into Hang On Sloopy from 1965. On Sloopy by the McCoys from 1965, a Burt Burns song. Also, a song you'll know very well, associated with Janis Joplin. This is Peace of My Heart by Big Brother and the Holding Company from 1968. Peace of My Heart by Big Brother and the Holding Company from 1968. I think the second version of that Burt Burns song. Before that, we also heard Hang On Sloopy, which Joel Selvin, author of the Burt Burns biography Here Comes the Night, that was originally My Girl Sloopy, and then it turns into Hang On Sloopy. How does that transition happen?
My Girl Sloopy was a 1964 record by The Vibrations, written and produced by Burt Burns. And it is just a badass piece of Afro-Cuban R&B. Mm-hmm. Maybe some of the most pure Havana rock on the charts ever. I mean, that song was recorded like 15 times that year. There were four different chart versions. The Yardbirds did a version. The Little Caesar and the Consuls had a huge hit in Canada with it, much bigger than the McCoys. And I mean, even Ramsey Lewis, the jazz pianist, did an instrumental version. It was just like an instant classic.
You describe in the book the McCoys version as Burt Burns hitting the trifecta, like it's a horse race. It is, he owns the song. It's he
wrote the song, published the song, and had it out on his record label.
And so for him, that is... that's reaching a pinnacle of his career. Let's back up a little bit and talk about who this guy, Burt Burns, is. Born in the Bronx, a Jewish kid, and grows up really loving the, especially the Latin music that he's hearing growing up. How does he encounter Mambo, and why does he embrace it?
You know, Mambo was just a huge phenomenon in the New York City boroughs in the late 40s, early 50s. All kind of emanates from the Machito, who started his Afro-Latin jazz band up in Spanish Harlem before the war, but didn't really move downtown until after the war. And once that happened, it started to spread the Palladian Ballroom and all that. In the Bronx, there was a small place called the Tremont Terrace, and all the Mambo bands, Noro Morales, Tito Puente, Tito Rodriguez, worked this room.
Para que venga a gozar y si quiere.
That's where Burns started the mambo dancing and met up with Sid Bernstein, who was running the little mambo hall, and they tried to start a record company, and that was in 1950. They put out one, two records, and then they were out of business in a minute. Burns, it wasn't until he was 30 years old that he got into the music business, and he got a job as a song plugger for a music publisher, $50 a week. In the first year, he was writing songs, not too much going on, really sort of mundane, gimmicky songs. Once he tripped across the combination of mambo and rock and roll, like we heard in Twist and Shout with the Isley Brothers, he found his voice and almost immediately became successful. Within 2 years of being in the record business, he was living in a penthouse, making hit records, and had a fishbowl stuffed with royalty checks he was too busy to take to the bank. Burns's musical style was so strong that other musicians and other record producers recognized it. He's not known for it amongst the record-listening public, but let me think about this for a minute with me. The Phil Spector record with the Righteous Brothers, You've Lost That Loving Feeling, goes to a middle eight where Spector puts the two vocalists up against each other and go, yeah, yeah, right? Mm-hmm. And underneath it, it goes, boom, 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 boom.
I'm talking with Joel Selvin, longtime pop critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. He's the author of the new book, Here Comes the Night: The Dark Soul of Burt Burns and the Dirty Business of Rhythm and Blues. It's out now. I'm soundcheck producer Joel Meyer. You've alluded to his early years in the business. He comes in as a successful songwriter, then becomes a full-fledged record man, like with his own label. How did he make that transition?
Well, this again goes back to the heart condition. This was a man with a short time to live, driven with ambition, and as soon as he started being successful, he started piling success on top of success. He went from a songwriter with no hits to a songwriter who produced his own records and made hits. As a producer, he moved into Atlantic Records, where he supervised the career of Solomon Burke, who was the only star on Atlantic Records at that point.
When your baby leaves you all alone, and nobody calls you on the phone, don't you feel like a cry? Don't you feel like a cry? Well, here I am, honey. Come on.
I'm going to ask you a question that I don't know how well you can answer how much you know about it, but in reading your book, Joel, I was shocked to learn of the influence of organized crime in the music business. How much does the mob help him make that ascent?
Okay, that's a huge part of the book, because it's really important to draw the relative moral universe in which Burns operated. These guys in the New York R&B scene were a click above a racket, and nobody paid any attention to them. You know, the graft and corruption that was rampant with radio stations, the refusal to pay royalties, the theft of songwriting credits. I mean, this stuff was commonplace.
Let's talk about the song that gives your book its name, Here Comes the Night. Every time I hear this song, Joel, I'm reminded this is an amazing song. It is a really weird song. It's strange sounding. Tell me a little bit about the genesis of this song.
Well, Burns liked to push his singers to the edge of heartbreak. And it didn't matter to him whether the song was a love song, or he wanted his singers crying. He wanted his singers in intense emotional upheaval. So Here Comes the Night was a song that he presented to them, which featured young Van Morrison. When he went
the
to
sort
London,
of Irish rockers,
they'd been signed to Decca Records in the United Kingdom, and Burns went over to England in 1963 after Twist and Shout hit and ran some experimental sessions that were the first time an American producer worked in English recording studios. They were a little backwards in England. I mean, the engineers wore lab coats, okay, in the studios. The song has pieces of it in a number of other Burn songs. There They Go by the Exciters is about the same thing. There's a Benny King song where he just comes to a stop break and shouts, "Here comes the night." Lyrically, it's about a guy seeing his girlfriend walking with another guy. But somehow this takes on this dramatic, dark foreboding in the chorus.
Well, I think you can hear the darkness that Joel Sullivan, my guest, is talking about. Here is that song, "Here Comes the Night," recorded by them, hit in 1965. Here Comes the Night by them from 1965, a song penned by Burt Burns, the subject of the book Here Comes the Night by my guest, Joel Sullivan. Joel, who's playing guitar on that song?
That's a 20-year-old British session player named Jimmy Page.
And how much did he help shape the sound of that song? The guitar line in that song is one of my favorite parts.
So that lick comes off of a record that Burns did with a singer named Marv Johnson. And it's just thrown away in that record, just a little dut, 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 dut. And he used it, Burns was great at recycling parts, and he used it when he got to England in the record and showed it to Page. Page changed the guitar positions and just sprayed gold into the track.
I'm talking with Joel Sullivan, author of Here Comes the Night, here in the Soundcheck studio. I'm Joel Meyer. So we've talked a little bit about Burt Burns, his early years as a songwriter, transitioning into a staff producer role in the early 60s at Atlantic Records. And then there's Bang Records. That's his sort of move towards his own piece of the pie, and kind of bankrolled by Atlantic, right?
Yeah, 17 grand.
17 grand.
That's what they put up, yeah.
And then in the book you describe the offices, which is really just a room with him and a secretary in it.
It did move to a larger suite after they had some success, but originally it was one room, two desks.
How successful was Bang Records? I mean, that's not a label that I really knew before digging into your book.
Well, the first record was The Strange Loves, I Want Candy. That was a top 10 record. Mm-hmm. About 3 months later, they had the number one hit with Hang On, Sloopy. So out of the box, that was a pretty good start.
And then it goes on to release records from Neil Diamond by Van Morrison. So, I mean, it sounds like it was pretty successful.
Well, very. He also started a subsidiary for R&B called Shout Records. And Freddie Scott had a number one R&B hit in 1966 for him with Are You Lonely For Me, Baby.
You've been working on this book, essentially, you've been working to tell this story for about 15 years or so. What for you really struck you about the Burt Burns story?
Well, like you say, Joel, I heard his life in those songs. I heard his pain. I heard his despair. I heard his medical condition. I heard his panic. And that's so uncommon for records of that era. They were light, frothy, you know, don't say nothing bad about my baby, you know, teenage stuff. This stuff wasn't teenage. This stuff was coming out of some dark, deep place in his soul.
Well, Joel Sullivan, before we let you go, I need to ask you about your favorite Burt Burns song. You know, we've heard some of the major songs that he was a part of that he either wrote or helped get made. Tell us about a more obscure Burt Burns song that is close to your heart.
Well, there's so many, it would be hard to pick one. But what I want you to hear today, Joel, is the original version of Peace of My Heart by Irma Franklin, Aretha's sister. It's Paul Griffin, the piano player's introduction, is so stately, and it sets this thing up. And she sings this with more calm, more depth, more, what I want to say, emotional realism than the kind of hysterical version that Janis does. And you can really feel Burns' pathology in this version.
Well, we're going to leave you with that. Joel Selvin is the longtime music journalist for the San Francisco Chronicle. His new book is called Here Comes the Night, The Dark Soul of Burt Burns and the Dirty Business of Rhythm and Blues. Joel, thanks so much for being on Soundcheck.
Great to be here.
Soundcheck executive producer Joel Meyer talking with Joel Selvin, author of the biography Here Comes the Night. You'll be hearing more about songwriter Burt Burns this summer with a new stage musical called Peace of My Heart, named after this song that Burns co-wrote with Jerry Ragavoy. Peace of My Heart opens off-Broadway in New York in July at the Signature Center, with previews starting on June 25th. Coming up, live music from Nashville's Moon Taxi. Next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Moon Taxi is the name of this Nashville-based quintet. They're joining me here in the studio today. An early reviewer of Moon Taxi said their music combined, and I'll quote here, roots rhythms, Latinismo, fishy riffs, complex fusion and gut bucket, and blue-collar rock into a pretty enjoyable ball that they hurl with serious gusto. Not sure what all that means, but they've added and subtracted some of those sounds over the years. The gusto is still evident, and they have a new album out called Mountains, Beaches, Cities. Moon Taxi is here in our New York studio to play live for us, and they'll begin with this song called The New Black.
I've seen it all before. something more. So what you give, oh, you can't get back.
That is Moon Taxi, live on Soundcheck here in our WNYC studio, and their song, The New Black. Trevor Turndrup singing and playing the guitar, Tommy Putnam on bass, Tyler Ritter behind our drum kit, Spencer Thompson playing actually our guitar, and Wes Bailey at our piano. So, did you guys bring anything to the party today, or did we supply it all?
You supplied the majority of the party.
We did supply most of it. Trevor, to you and the rest of the band, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having us, Trevor.
Are you suggesting that WNYC is the new black? I heard the little shout out there towards the end of the song.
Yes, it is. The new black.
What does that mean? I mean, are you a fan of the TV show Orange is the New Black?
We are, and we actually got a chance to play for the Lionsgate people in LA when we were last there, and we were like, hey guys, we have this song, Orange is the New Black, and that was before I watched the series.
Then
I watched the series, and that song totally would not fit. You know, they typically use female vocals,
right?
And I love their theme song, the Regina Spektor.
Really
love their, I mean, their, that show is fantastic.
You know, one of the sort of women of a certain age in the cast is Annie Golden, who was the lead singer of The Shirts, who were the house band in the first flowering of punk at CBGB's.
I did not know about that or about The Shirts. I need to do some research there.
In the cast.
But no, The New Black, we just kind of borrowed the expression, and you know, I love how applicable it is to WNYC.
To everything. So, have I heard that? Is that in a commercial or something, or is it just such an earworm that the first time I hear it on the record, I think, I've heard this before?
I think that's what we were going for, that kind of familiarity.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it ended up in a BMW commercial recently.
Okay, that's where I heard.
It was aired on the Olympics.
So what is a Moon Taxi?
Moon Taxi, that's is the new black. Moon Taxi is the new black.
Now, you guys you're basically doing the festival circuit this summer, right?
Yeah, with the exception of, like, Coachella. We're not out in Coachella. We're not doing Bonnaroo this year because we played it two years back. But, yeah, we're doing a bunch of them.
And, you know, who are you excited to see? I mean, when you look ahead and you see, oh, we're going to be at this festival with so-and-so, that's going to be great.
We're going to try to catch Outkast. I mean, they're on every single festival, but I don't know if the timing is going to work out. You know, I mean, sometimes we get to play a festival and stay the whole weekend and have a great time, and sometimes we have to roll out right after the show. It'd be awful if, like, they're playing every single festival that, you know, they're at all the ones that we're at and not see them.
And you just, like, trail after them, just missing them at each stop.
Yeah.
So you're also doing a full set of Rage Against the Machine songs at this festival in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something you guys have done, maybe not full sets, but you've been covering their songs for a while, right?
We have been for a while. It's been a great challenge for us because stylistically it's, you know, couldn't be a further away band. But it was, we started out learning Evil Empire. We wanted to learn that whole record. Just for some reason, I don't know if one day we just woke up and said, hey, let's learn a bunch of Rage Against the Machine. But it's a cool change and different side of us, and the challenge was fun. Uh-huh. And Spencer, our lead guitarist, does all the rapping on it. So it's fun to drop in the middle of a set, you know, because people, you know, sometimes they're focused on the lead singer,
right.
And then all of a sudden this guy comes rapping, and he's a good rapper.
So if Spencer is taking the role of Zach, who is taking the role of Tom?
I am.
Morello. You're
I
Tom
am.
Morello.
I'm Tom Morello. Which
have you met Tom?
I have not. I would like to meet him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite guitar players, you know, living right now.
Mm-hmm.
Very inventive, and I try to do homage to his playing and learn things verbatim. So that's what we've been trying to do is just do them justice.
Right. Now, when the band Deer Tick do their Nirvana covers, they call it Deervana.
Right.
So do you guys have a name for
it? Yeah, we call it People of the Sun. So it's the
People of the Sun.
The opposite,
okay.
Moon Taxi.
Moon
People
Taxi,
of the Sun.
People of the Sun. All right. So, folks, you've been warned. If you see People of the Sun on the bill, it's these guys doing Rage Against the Machine songs. Moon Taxi, though, is the name of the band. The album is called Mountains, Beaches, Cities. I really like this next song you're going to do, Morocco. Not so much about the real Morocco, it seems.
It's just kind of the idea of getting to, you know, this mystical place.
Point being that it's this idea of...
Uh-huh, of traveling to a foreign land. And we just got done shooting a video out in Joshua Tree.
Hmm. Which stands in for Morocco, I guess, fairly well.
It looked pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah.
You want to play it for us?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. The band is Moon Taxi. The album's called Mountains, Beaches, Cities, and this song is called Morocco.
Thank you.
That is Moon Taxi with their song Morocco, live on Soundcheck. You'll find it also on their album, Mountains, Beaches, Cities, which is their latest. You guys want to do something a little older for us from the 2012 album, Cabaret?
Yeah, we'd like to do Mercury from Cabaret.
All right. Once again, it's the band Moon Taxi, live on Soundcheck. Once again, the band Moon Taxi, live on Soundcheck with a song called Mercury. They have a new album out called Mountains, Beaches, Cities, but that is from 2012's album Cabaret. And once again, Trevor Turndrip singing and playing guitar, Spencer Thompson on guitar, Wes Bailey behind our piano, Taylor Ritter behind the drum kit, and Tommy Putnam playing the bass. And that album Cabaret, was that Trevor, was that where the kind of shift in sound first started to happen?
It sure was. Yeah, that was. We kind of reinvented ourselves and changed the way that we wrote songs. We didn't write songs in a practice room. We didn't write songs for the live setting, which we had been doing in the past. Mm-hmm. We made a conscious effort to, you know, really think about what it takes to make a good studio record. And so And that's when we started to have Spencer be the exclusive like producer.
Producer, yeah. Yeah. So that you guys maintained control over the exactly. sound. Well, the results are there for all to hear on the album Mountains, Beaches, Cities from the band Moon Taxi. Trevor, to you and the rest of the band, thanks so much for joining
thanks
us
Thanks for
today.
Having us, John.
This is Soundcheck. Tomorrow on the show, the piano player and songwriter Tori Amos is set to release a new album in 2 weeks. It'll be called Unrepentant Geraldines, and it marks a return to the soaring piano pop that she's become famous for. She'll play 2 new songs for us, plus an old favorite from her debut record. That's tomorrow on the show, but if you just can't wait, you can hear our session with Tori Amos right now over on soundcheck.org. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katsif, with Amy Pearl and our intern Ryan Kyloff. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. That does it for the show today. Our theme music is written and played by Marco Benevento. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.